This is a download from Forced Migration Online. To find out more, please go to www.forcedmigration.org.
Start. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Alex Betts. I'm convening the RSC public seminar series this term. And as you'll be aware, the theme is critical approaches to environmental displacement. And I just want to start by saying a little bit to introduce the series to you, and then introduce Brand Blitz, first speaker in the series. Environmental displacement and environmental migration have become very significant emerging topics in migration studies, in forced migration, in the humanitarian literature, and for scholars working on climate change and environmental issues. And it's become an extremely popular, fashionable, and voguish topic on which there's a burgeoning literature now in the policy world and the academic world. But a lot of that literature, I think, can be characterized in a couple of ways. There's an emerging literature that really tries to show causality, particularly at the macro level, between environmental change and migration and displacement. And there's an emerging literature on the normative and institutional dimensions of the debate. But for me, one of the things that's really been missing from that debate, with a number of notable exceptions, is a critical perspective on environmental displacement in this particular context, but also environmental migration more broadly. And in particular, what I'm hoping to do with this series is bring together people who are thinking in critical ways about at least two aspects of that debate, two key questions that I think are driving the series. The first of those questions is, on what basis can we conceive of valid social scientific understandings about the relationship between the environment and displacement? What kind of knowledge is valid as a reasonable basis to justify policy interventions and the kind of interventions that may or may not be required? And how is social science currently being used to engage with policy and being developed in academia? And the second big related question is to do with the politics of representation in this area. How is causal knowledge being instrumentalized by people from different aspects of politics, whether it's states, NGOs, international organizations, or even academics? So the purpose of this series is a dialogue across a number of scholars who, in different ways, from different disciplines, geography, anthropology, politics, even philosophy, are thinking critically about those knowledge-based questions and the politics of representation in this area. And I'm absolutely thrilled to have as our opening speaker, Professor Brad Blitz. Brad Blitz. It's problematic if you have a name like a superhero. We stumble over it every time. Brad is Professor of Human and Political Geography at Kingston University in London. And he's well known to many of us working in Oxford because for a long time he's been a research associate at the RSC and a great collaborator with many people working in Oxford, including myself. He's also been based for much of his career in Oxford. Before moving to Kingston University, he was the John Monet Chair at Oxford Brookes, and in addition to that, he's produced a prolific amount of academic research across areas of human rights, migration, forced migration, publishing in some of the most established journals in those areas, but also publishing really foundational and insightful books. Most recently, he's known for his work on statelessness in particular. He's the founder of the International Observatory on Statelessness, an observatory that managed to serve as a platform through which dialogue and knowledge dissemination and knowledge gathering has really been brought together on the issue of statelessness. And he's produced in 2011 alone two really significant, compelling edited volumes on the topic, Statelessness in the European Union, with Caroline Sawyer, published by Cambridge University Press, and Statelessness and Citizenship, published with Maureen Lynch, with Edward Elgar Press. And they've become some of the most compelling references in an issue that's really emerged. And now Brad is turning his attention more and more to issues of environmental displacement and climate change-related migration. And so we're delighted to have him here to open the series on the topic of environmental displacement, future scenarios, and modes of protection to re-examine. So welcome, Brad. Thank you.
you very much, Alex, for that kind introduction. It's always welcome to be back here. I'm going to approach today's talk really building on this project which I carried out for UNDP last year, where the focus was very much on identifying ways of understanding location security. And in that context, I should say, the issues around forced migration and migration, economic and otherwise, were fairly blurred. But today what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus specifically on small island states, because I think the protection issues there are more clear-cut. And I'm going to put forward an argument about looking at ways of resolving problems at the local level. I'm going to look at how we might be able to clarify protection responses specifically with respect to small island states, looking at creative approaches, and I'm then going to look at some promising practices or examples of good practice from the Asian context. Let me just say that the background summary for the seminar invites closer scrutiny of purported causal connections between environmental change and anticipated displacement. And I think this is very helpful because much of what has come out from watchdogs, including the IPCC, over the last 20 years has had a very strong deterministic edge to it. And I think that we need to investigate some of those claims much more carefully. Now, we have some handouts here. I've just summarized some of the anticipated threats of climate change which are central to the arguments which have been made by the IPCC and colleagues at the University of East Anglia in particular. Come around. I think it's easier to read from the handout than from the slide, but the coming back to you. Basically, there are four main categories that we can consider here. Vulnerable livelihoods, poverty, weak states, and migration. And when we consider them, vulnerable livelihoods addresses issues around resource availability, resource scarcity. Issues around poverty seem to concentrate around issues around access to natural capital and sustainability in terms of vulnerable livelihoods. And with respect to weak states, it's very much the infrastructure that seems to be challenged by extreme weather events. And then we come down to migration, which is considered really just one response and one mode of adaptation. Now, I should say that the table in the slides that I've just discussed doesn't provide evidence of direct causality, and I think we should be clear on that. But what it does suggest is that there's some convergence between the first two impacts, vulnerable livelihoods and poverty, and convergence in as far as they may make people more vulnerable to the negative effects of extreme weather events, climate change. And the second set of factors with respect to weak states and migration, which are seen as some of the negative consequences of it, again, adaptation. Now, before discussing such claims, one central question regarding the nature of human displacement seems to loom large in my book, and that is, why do people migrate? Now, this is one of my favorite exam questions. And I'm not going to give you the full answer, but by way of an answer, let me just set out some claims which I believe help to inform the discussion. And that is, first, we know from other contexts that migration, even forced migration, is a complex process and is the product of often personal and collective household-level based decisions. and anticipated responses to environmental hazards and disasters equally must be informed by evidence of personal and more local motivations for migration. We need to know more specifically from the islanders, from the villagers and others, not necessarily the governmental representatives or the technocrats or the scientists who are speaking on their behalf, what factors may influence their decision to migrate. And that very much resonates with, as I understand it, the theme of the seminar series, which invites more micro-level investigations of the problem. Now, second, and on a related point, there's a substantial body of writing on migration, which records that people's decisions are often based on insufficient information on which to evaluate conditions in the receiving context. And this explains why people leave situations of poverty only to migrate to sites of major unemployment or insecurity, or where they may be forced to take their chances in an urban slum or a dangerous refugee camp setting, or even to make a perilous journey. So migration decisions are based on projected outcomes, and we must accept that migrants sometimes get it wrong. Third, how we evaluate the risks and anticipated dangers depends on our resources. They depend on our resources, our perceptions of the threats, and options for adaptation. And I often comment on the fact that even though I narrowly avoided a Category 4 hurricane in Jamaica, where I got on the last flight out of Montego Bay, and these were some of the scenes, in spite of that, the Blitz family nevertheless seems to holiday almost every year in peak hurricane season in Florida, in spite of multiple warnings. And these were some of the warnings that we got just really a day before we got on the plane, I have to say. So just to emphasize the point that for some reason we seem to feel somewhat more secure. Perhaps unwisely so. Perhaps if I come back next year, it will be under very different circumstances. But just to illustrate the point. Fourth, if we consider the experience of environmental displacement in other regions, such as South Asia and Southeast Asia, where people live with the threats of floods, cyclones, and the like, it's above all changes in livelihoods which determine when migrants leave and how long for. And this is some of the evidence from the recent Foresight report, which notes that environmental factors are by no means key in driving migration. So all of this is to say that people don't just leave because there's a great danger. There has to be a trigger. And it is vital to understand these triggers if we're to support calls for assistance, either in the form of mitigation or adaptation, including resettlement. And the central premise of this presentation is that there are many factors that influence the decision to migrate, above all, livelihood-level considerations. Environmental pressures are but one contributing factor. And here are some explanations as to what may be some push factors, what are some of the pull factors, how do they feature in what we are describing as environmental-induced migration. It seems there's greater recognition that climatic factors influence the decision to migrate directly following actual or anticipated environmental hazards. They may also affect the decision to migrate indirectly, that is, by stripping away sources of security. For example, climatic changes may reduce access to natural resources, including land, water, soil, and biological resources, including forests, thereby creating unsustainable conditions. Now, the second handout we have. Actually, no, this isn't a handout. I need to figure out how to work this. Here we are. So some key push and pull factors are summarized.
Grab the alternatives.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Here are some... Sorry, I've got it wrong. Well, The previous table actually identified some of the key push and pull factors. And here are some of the vulnerable groups that may be at risk and which have been identified by the IPCC and in subsequent reports. So by no means do they include what we may traditionally call forced migrants. There are many, many issues that may expedite their displacement. Actually, we have a table here. So in order to develop an informed policy, we need to ask the natives. It should go without saying, of course, but many policymakers are not anthropologically trained. We need to ask, what are the interests of the most vulnerable? And also we must recognize, even in situations where it seems incomprehensible to us, that many of those people who fall into the category of affected persons there, many of them may not be keen on resettlement, say, even though to the outsider it may look like they face an existential threat. So by way of this long introduction, my aim is to consider the ways in which we can advance a case for greater protection. And my central concern, as I said, is with endangered states, though I recognize that this is selective, and there are large regions in states such as Bangladesh and China which cannot be excluded from the wider discussion, and that is the reason for actually including this here. So, focusing on endangered islands, the argument I'll develop is an instrumental one. I will suggest that there are ways in which we can mobilize existing instruments to call attention to the needs of populations in peril, including drawing upon the idea of de facto statelessness, which has been recognized by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in certain situations, and to explore other hooks which might advance a protection-centered agenda. I will then explore cases where local leaders and community-based organizations have identified their own protection options and have executed strategies for their own protection, often against considerable odds. Now, let me provide some further background, and this is one major problem which I see has hindered the development of an informed agenda for protection. And that is, there seem to be competing groups of scholars, UN agencies, and other communities that remain quite disconnected from each other. More than 20 years ago, the IPCC stated that the greatest single impact of climate change should be on human migration. And it described the prospect of millions of people displaced by issues around coastal erosion, flooding, and drought, and highlighted the dangers of soil erosion, increased salination, pollution, and the overall deterioration of agricultural lands. Since then, there has been growing acceptance that both dramatic and cumulative changes in climatic patterns present a major challenge to the security of people across the developing world, giving rise to potentially unprecedented levels and forms of migration. But in spite of the growing consensus around the dangers that extreme weather events may pose to human security, there's been little focus on the need for protection and the prospect of resettlement in particular. Nor indeed has there been much discussion of the ways in which migration should be managed. Recent studies which have linked climate change to migration have so far failed to reach agreement on the ways in which environmental and demographic challenges should be addressed. Moreover, climate change, migration, and development are increasingly discussed within separate international fora. And it seems irrefutable that climate change has not yet been mainstreamed in migration policies and discourses on protection, though there are signs of some movement, and of course seminars such as this point us in the right direction. So what opportunities are there to promote an agenda for protection for low-lying island states? In some of the most extreme situations, one way may be to invoke the need for protection by mobilizing the label of statelessness, throwing open the door to UNHCR, and upping the diplomatic ante further by raising the question of resettlement. Now, from the outset, let me say that these two issues are highly controversial. First, The meaning of de facto statelessness is subject to considerable debate within the emerging literature on statelessness and within UNHCR. And if we consider the 2010 project conclusions, and I know that some people here attended that conference, which was the site of a meeting among key scholars working on statelessness, it's clear that the definition is not especially helpful. The concluding text from Prato drew certain themes more associated with the refugee convention, again with territorial exclusions. It described de facto stateless people as persons outside the country of their nationality who are unable or for valid reasons are unwilling to avail themselves of protection of that country. Protection in this sense refers to the right to diplomatic protection exercised by a state of nationality in order to remedy an internationally wrongful act against one of its nationals, as well as diplomatic and consular protection and assistance generally, including in relation to the state of nationality. So clearly from that definition, the fate of people who may be imperiled as a result of what some people are describing as sinking islands, it doesn't particularly fit. But nonetheless, I believe there is a case that one can make for protection, and I will return to that. And second, we need to recognize that resettlement is highly controversial because it prioritizes the role of the receiving state. And since 9/11, I should add, the number of people resettled by UNHCR has fallen significantly. Indeed, in the environmental context, resettlement has received even less interest, except in situations of involuntary resettlement, often as a result of large infrastructure, hydroelectric, and military projects in places such as China, Vietnam, and elsewhere in Asia. And there's a large piece in today's New York Times about the development of hydropower and the construction of more dams in Cambodia, again raising these very questions. But if resettlement is the option of last resort, it is crucially important to the discussion around climate change because it serves as a glaring reminder that while policy discourse is concentrated at the global and transnational levels, climate change disproportionately affects poor developing states which are already struggling. As I said just a few moments ago, I believe the lack of agreement among climate change scholars has frustrated the search for effective systems of frustration and has stymied discussion of resettlement options. This intellectual discord has created two essential problems. First, by de-emphasizing the role of social, political, and economic factors in the migration decision-making process, it prevents environmental agents as lacking agency. And this is something that I'm going to contest in my discussion of the case study. I'm going to focus very much on efforts which demonstrate that such migrants do have agency. Second, it frames the nature of the political responses by insisting on only certain legally defined categories of migrants, including refugees, asylum seekers, irregular migrants, and stateless migrants. And personally, I would say that this is what I feel is one of the main shortcomings of the Foresight Report. The fact that environmentally induced migrants seem to fall between several camps. They cannot be considered refugees, a point I will mention in a moment. They're not yet considered stateless, and they are simply vulnerable people. So where does this leave us, and what options are there for protection, including resettlement? For guidance on resettlement, there are very few places to turn to. And I recognize that I'm in the company of some legal scholars here, so I will try to be brief and as accurate as possible. But the main instrument that we seem to return to is the 1951 Refugee Convention, which has been the primary instrument for organized resettlement. And this is of limited value because it describes refugees as those who have a well-founded fear of persecution for specific reasons and who have crossed an international border. Those displaced by environmental factors are not covered by the definition of a refugee stated in Article 1. And indeed, there's been considerable resistance to include such people within the convention. Such resistance was illustrated in the Foresight Report. And by by many of those who are keen to, or rather they perhaps perceive any diversification as a way of watering down the Refugee Convention and the way in which protection is to be organized. There are some who wish to challenge the exclusion of forced environmental migrants from the convention. One initiative to note is the Living Space for Environmental Refugees initiative, and I've got colleagues in the States who are actually working on the genesis of a new convention, which could take things forward. The Living Space for Environmental Refugees initiative has, I should add, been endorsed by the governments of Maldives, Tuvalu, and other small island developing states. And so there is a sense among those who are in the line of danger that there is a need to find alternative instruments. Nevertheless, I should say the convention does offer a legal basis for resettlement as a route to integration, and I believe that this could be called upon to inform other situations. We know that resettlement involves the selection and transfer of refugees, according to the convention, from a state in which they've sought protection to a third state. The convention demands that status providers should ensure protection against reformment and provide a resettled refugee in this instance and his or her family and dependents with access to civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights similar to those enjoyed by nationals. So a strong emphasis on non-discrimination. And it should carry with it the opportunity to become naturalized. It should be noted that even for those who qualify for resettlement under the Refugee Convention, this is the least preferred option. The preferred durable solution remains repatriation, which is obviously not something which could be envisaged in the state where you have in the situation where a state no longer officially exists. Further, when we look at the UNHCR resettlement handbook, it stipulates that the decision to resettle must be based on, quote, what difference, if any, this option would make in addressing the immediate and long-term problems and the needs of individual refugee or groups of refugees, and to what degree it would in fact serve as a durable solution. It also makes clear that resettlement relies on the goodwill of states to receive refugees, and that no country is legally obliged to resettle them. So, yet there are ways in which protection can be invoked without recourse to the term refugee or by extending the definition. And one interesting example is what the United States has done. And we note that under Section B of the Immigration and Nationality Act, the U.S. can recognize people as refugees who are still in their country of origin, and that there are special provisions for establishing presumptive claims to refugee status. What they've done is they've shifted the emphasis from the territorial limitations associated with the convention's definition of the refugee, and rather have come up with the term of acute vulnerability, which enables them to offer protection in a more versatile context. Other legal scholars who have been working on this, again with a view to environmental-induced migration, such as Scott Leckie, have sought to identify protection needs by distinguishing between types of displacement without having recourse to the term refugee. Some have identified ways in which protection may be grounded in existing human rights law, noting that the consequences of environmental-induced migration, climate change in this instance, affect the full spectrum of civil, cultural, economic, political, and social rights, since they relate to the right to life, the right to health, the right to food, and an adequate standard of living, and many more. For this reason, Leckie suggests that there is a reasonably strong basis from which to demand positive and well-planned action by states and others to develop the means necessary to protect and secure all of these rights for climate-displaced persons. Others have provided some creative solutions for recasting territorial attachment as the primary basis for state and international protection in the absence of a comprehensive and applicable refugee rights framework. One way in which they've done so is by considering the legal obligations on states to protect stateless people and reaffirm commitment to protect the human rights of all. The statelessness conventions have not been ratified by many countries. Indeed, the only Asian country which had signed the 1954 convention was the Republic of Korea. Recently, the UN High Commissioner of Refugees has evoked the term de facto statelessness to express the protection needs of specific populations at risk, for example, the Maldives and Vanuatu, which face the possible physical destruction of their national habitat. And the issue is important because even if UNHCR may be reluctant to engage in the resettlement of refugees, the term statelessness expands upon existing protection claims and potentially draws the populations that were mentioned within UNHCR's remit. And as we know, this is a remit which has grown considerably over the last few years with a budget that has expanded and an issue which has been increasingly mainstreamed across UNHCR, as evidenced by the High Commissioner's dialogue just last year. So involving UNHCR more closely could entail using the resources of regional and country offices to build a stronger evidence base for advocacy and policy development. And this would no doubt help to strengthen the profile of experts and NGOs working with endangered states. Equally, this might help to inform people of their rights to land, resettlement, and broader protection. Such coordinated support would, in my view, assist both states and communities that are exploring land banking remedies and the possibility of expropriating land for resettlement purposes. Here it's helpful to consider where states, imperiled states and communities, have explored such options. And the examples I'm going to present include a range of scenarios from physical adjustment in the case of internal environmental displacees, and as a means of re-establishing a state in the situation of future stateless groups. So I'm going to draw some examples, first of all, from the South Pacific Islands, where some of these attempts at mitigation have been addressed. Several island atolls in Melanesia, Micronesia, and Polynesia have been identified as being at risk of rising sea levels and the effects that inundation will cause to coral systems, coastlines, and natural resources. The Carteret Islands of Papua New Guinea are a remote series of islands which are particularly at risk both physically and culturally. What is interesting here is that land has historically played an essential role in the organization of clans and determining the social structure of community life. Land ownership is carefully mediated. Land is owned by women and is passed down from mother to daughter. The status of women is therefore also linked to land ownership. The islands have drawn considerable attention from the press, which has reported on a situation of coastal erosion where rising waters have swamped valuable land, removing the thin soil crust and destroying fruit trees and other staples. The incoming waters have also brought higher levels of malaria and malnutrition among children. Some islanders also provided accounts of sharks and stingrays engulfing their local habitat, which they describe as dangerous. More than 60% of the territory has fallen below sea level, and two uninhabited islands disappeared in 1999, and another island has been cut into by the sea. Here is one account of the situation facing the islands. Saltwater inundation contaminates freshwater supplies, and the island's few wells are now only good for washing. To drink, the islanders must collect rain in water tanks or rely on rapidly diminishing supplies of coconut milk. Carteret Islanders used to be able to feed themselves by fishing and farming, but saltwater inundation also destroys the islanders' food supplies and the capacity of the soils to grow food plants. Traditional crops including coconut and sago palms, bananas, breadfruit, papaya, cassava, tapioca, sugarcane, and taro once existed. But today, fish and coconuts from the remaining palms are the only food the islanders have left. The autonomous Bougainville government supplies rice to the islands, but shipments arrive at irregular intervals. There is also growing dependency culture on the islands, which destroys the social and cultural fabric. In response to the threat posed to the Carteret Islands, the autonomous region of Bougainville, some 86 kilometers away, offered to resettle 10 families first in 1984. But these initial migrants returned in 1989 feeling insecure due to the civil war. Since then, some local activists claim that there's been little done either by Bougainville or Papua New Guinea, the government of Papua New Guinea, to assist the islanders' relocation. In the absence of sufficient state assistance, and before other countries recognized their plight, I should add Australia did commit funds as well, the Council of Elders formed an organization, Tulula Pesa, called Sailing the Waves on Our Own, which was a non-profit association to organize the voluntary relocation of the population of some 6,000 inhabitants of the islands and neighboring atolls to the larger island of Bougainville. Tulula Pesa is headed by a former Oxfam employee, Ursula Rakova, who has led an energetic campaign to acquire resources and organize a complex resettlement program. And interestingly, she has also advised other NGOs in distant parts of the world, including Alaska, as to how people there may conceive of resettlement and organize their resources accordingly. Now, as a result of her leadership, the organization has received support from the Catholic Church, which provided land for the families. A further 20 families migrated on their own. And the organization has since acquired more than 30 acres on Bougainville. And it's reported that 80 other families will next move, with an additional 50 following, and a small number remaining, uncertain if they will relocate. Tulula Pesa attempts to resettle the population on 3 locations over a 10-year period, and has established an exchange program in order to enable chiefs, women, and youth from host communities and the Carteres to be socialized in both cultures. In addition, the relocation program provides a range of services, such as carpentry, to help with the construction of alternative housing, and has developed some income-generating projects around the rehabilitation of cocoa and coconut, and education, health, and community development training programs. An interesting dimension of the island relocation plan is the conservation of the reef area, which may be used for future fishing activities. And to this end, there's a plan to develop an equitable sea transport service for freight and passengers. One community worker noted the possibility of linking sustainable fishing and the preservation of the islanders' heritage even from afar, and stated, "In the future, we will keep coming to these reefs and manage them as our fishing ground. When our children come back, they will have a connection to their heritage." I believe this is a particularly useful idea for potentially stateless groups who may need to think about how they can retain cultural connections to lost territory. The Carteret Islanders have, however, faced several obstacles to their resettlement plan, including a lack of recognition by host communities and the challenge of purchasing land on an island where customary ownership is the rule. Some have raised fears that resettlement will alter social relations within the local clans, and that without their original material home, it will prove difficult to retain their cultural heritage. Moreover, there's considerable awareness that in spite of an internationally monitored peace agreement, the civil conflict has left many questions over land ownership unanswered. Now, in other parts of the South Pacific, people not only face the prospect of environmental displacement, but statelessness. For example, for nationals of Tuvalu, one of the smallest countries in the world, migration and resettlement is considered to be the only viable option for the future. More than 3,000 Tuvaluans have migrated to Auckland, many prompted by concerns about their imperiled natural environment. To date, Australia has proved to be the preferred site for re-establishment of the state, and the population of Tuvalu has been encouraged by the development of skilled migrant schemes, which are bringing islanders to work in Australia, though the numbers remain very low. So this is one question that is being asked as to whether or not these islanders who are resettled on one of the islands, I'm trying to remember which one it is, as to whether or not they can reorganize something resembling a Tuvaluan state. Similarly, Kiribati is reporting to be looking to acquire land abroad in order to resettle up to 100,000 people. And this plan was announced at the 60th session of the UN General Assembly just 7 years ago. Their government has also devised a 3-year national action plan, which aims to reduce an unacceptable level of inequity, address population pressures, and protect biodiversity and prevent overexploitation. Some countries have looked to Australia and New Zealand as destinations for employment, while programs for resettlement are developed. But it's important to highlight that acceptance of labor migrants by 2 OECD states does not equate to their support of humanitarian protection and resettlement. Now, the perhaps best-known case is the case of the Maldives. And like the Pacific Island countries described above, Maldives faces particular physical threats. It's only 2.3 meters above sea level and faces the prospect of coastal erosion. Of all the low-lying island states, the Maldives has attracted the most attention to the perils of climate change and the dangers facing small island states. And should be noted as well that the Maldives recently graduated to join the middle-income group of states. Further publicity has been generated by the energetic president, Mohamed Amin Nasheed, who's conducted, as you see here, underwater cabinet meetings to raise attention of the threat posed to his country. He's also sought to use the UN system to raise the issue of climate change in order to press for a new international instrument. And in 2007, the Maldives developed a national adaption program of action relating to the anticipated effects of climate change. The main intention has been to improve the adaptive capacity of the state. And this action program identifies the most urgent and immediate needs of the country with regard to climate change. And under the president's leadership, it started to raise significant amounts of money to this end. It has also received funding from the European Union, which is helping the state to become carbon neutral. It's received considerable funding as well, I should add, from the UN's Least Developed Country Fund and UNDP for its Safer Island Strategy, which is an initiative that seeks to move people from, basically it's a program of concentration, moving people from smaller islands where they may have migrated for work or education, increasingly to the larger islands where they have a strong seawall as a means of territorial protection. So what does this mean for protection? While the idea of resettling entire populations threatened by environmental factors is unprecedented, the case studies record that strategies based on self-reliance and the mobilization of national and local resources may offer some ground for hope. Let me suggest how one might capitalize on the experience of some low-lying island states as discussed above. First, there are other relevant situations which inform this study and provide clues as to how endangered peoples have played the hand that they have been dealt, but still managed to preserve important social and political and authority-based institutions in the absence of a state. We note the attempts at resettlement in Montserrat, where a natural disaster saw internal movements and the reconcentration of part of the population in other areas of the island, while many others were resettled. There are also several examples where populations facing displacement and dispersal have found coping mechanisms which have enabled them to remain moored to particular territory, even after long periods of exile. In particular, I think about in the wake of an intensified occupation settlement program by the Chinese government in Tibet, the Tibetan diaspora has focused on promoting its unique culture among its populations in India as well as in China. There was actually quite a large article in today's New York Times about this, about the development of a Tibetan cultural center in an area concentrated by Han migrants, which they believe is actually performing a very important role in providing basic skills to ethnic Tibetans in terms of learning their language, developing greater literacy skills, and the like. And we should note that in the case of Tibet, the support of India has played a very critical role, which reiterates the importance of good neighborly relations as a basis for protection. Second, we should consider the history of relocation between the Maldivian Islands and the experimental resettlement of the Carteret Islands in Bougainville. In both cases, active leadership, community support, and efforts to build confidence with the local populations have proven to be the key to successful integration of the migrant groups. Third, it is imperative to clarify how international law and other political resources can be mobilized to protect the rights of those who face loss of territory and homeland. The prospect of recreating a state on newly acquired territory has not been the subject of much legal analysis, yet there's further need to examine how collective and specific group rights may be protected. Creative thinking about particular communitarian options is required here. And I should add, in this context, this is where I would turn to the political theorists to work with us to find ways of promoting mechanisms for protection which recognize communal particularities, authority-based systems within the wider context of international human rights law. To achieve these ends, effective advocacy is, of course, critical. I believe endangered states should follow the example set by dedicated leaders, and we note how the Maldivian president has called the world's attention to this country. Equally, the community leaders of Tululapesa, which, as I mentioned, are now advising other groups at risk. UNHCR continues to play a role here by identifying the protection needs of the above-mentioned people. It can continue to act as a conduit for resettlement, as it does elsewhere. Of course, to advance the cause of protection, further ratifications of the key conventions would be required. Equally, we need to think about the long-term issues associated with relocation and the need for integration support programs, including further technical and social assistance. I should add here that my research on refugee returns, repatriation, and return migration over the past decade has very much drawn home to me the realization that migration and resettlement are not by any account the end point of the protection cycle. And often the burden is just shifted, whether it's shifted from, say, UNHCR to the Red Cross. So there will be residual problems associated with local the social integration, inter-ethnic, intercommunal issues, education and health, and those too need attention. And of course, financial support will be required to resettle populations and to rebuild essential institutions, to provide funds to support some of the costs of migration. And again, UNHCR could play a role here, mobilizing the donor community. So let me conclude by saying that the prospects for displacement, especially in the examples that I've given, raise many questions regarding disaster preparedness, including national and international efforts to preserve systems of state governance in anticipation of territorial loss. The small-scale program of the Carteret Islands and the work of Tululapesa, though a domestic resettlement program, is nonetheless informative of some of the essential challenges that islanders may face. The main obstacles include potential disputes over land rights, financial investment, physical security, and agreement over cultural and minority rights on the host territory. In some cases, it may be possible to include people under the banner of de facto stateless. The term offers some traction and it recalls a situation of powerless, which is precisely connected to the loss of territorial attachment. It is also more flexible than the concept of refugee, which in the case of environmental displacement is still circumscribed by the restrictions of the 1951 Convention. The term stateless could draw further attention to the existential problems facing some low-lying island populations, but we must acknowledge that few states have ratified the conventions, and before one can exploit the term to good effect, further ratifications are required. One further challenge I would like to raise is the degree to which one may invoke national and territorial belonging as a means of pressing for protection. Here I wish to stress that the potential richness of international human rights is revealed by the possibility of disaggregating state and rights-based foundations for the protection of both individual and group rights. Further work is required not only to develop international law, to provide solutions to people who fall outside the conventions, namely the 1951 Refugee Convention and the 54 and 61 Statelessness Conventions, but also to elaborate on ways in which human rights may be practically protected through collective, ethno-national, community structures that may outlive the physical state. And here I turn to the political theorists, and yes, I shot a glance at you, Ruby, because I know that there are ways in which one might be able to exploit communitarian thinking to address this wider issue. In the meantime, it's essential first to know what the triggers are and what might encourage migration. Equally, to educate islanders of their rights to explore the option of purchasing land abroad. The development of an NGO coalition would no doubt help this process. And in this context, I should say that it's very pleasing to see that COIN is involved in the seminar series and that you will shortly have one of our colleagues coming to address you. Such a coalition might also serve to call upon UN agencies for further data gathering, for example, providing information to special rapporteurs and through raising awareness through the committee bodies, and also to keep UNHCR and other bodies more focused on the disproportionate effects that climate change will have on the protection needs of poor, isolated, and low-lying islands. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this download, you might like to listen to other podcasts of Forced Migration Online. www.forcedmigration.org/podcasts